Esther, we find ourselves coming to that book tonight as we, on these Sunday nights, head through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. That way, you know, we know we're going to hit everything. And we come to this book that is very interesting and very unique in several aspects. Historical context, we'll want to have that as it relates to the study of the Word on these Sunday nights. We've just been through the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. And both of those books share the same historical setting as the book of Esther. The book of Ezra and Nehemiah has to do with the remnant who left the Babylonian captivity following the fall of Babylon to return to Jerusalem. When Israel, the nation of Israel, fell, the northern kingdom of Israel fell first to the Assyrians. And then years later, the southern kingdom of Judah fell to the Babylonians. The Assyrians were a world-ruling empire. They were supplanted by the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar. And it was during that period that that southern kingdom went into captivity. But following the fall of the Babylonian Empire, another empire followed it called the Medo-Persian Empire. And the Medo-Persian Empire had a different attitude as it related to lands that they had conquered and the people that had been displaced from those lands. They allowed people to return back to their homelands. They felt that that was the best way to maintain a rule over a people. Capture their heart. Be good to them, be friendly to them, and they won't rebel against you. So when the rulers of the Medo-Persian Empire allowed the children of Israel to go back into Jerusalem, back to Judah, some of them did. And Ezra and Nehemiah is the account of those who returned to Jerusalem. The book of Esther is the account of the Jews who refused to go back to Jerusalem. They decided, we will stay here in Babylon. We will not go back to the land from which we've been taken. And so Esther deals with that same period, but those Jews that stayed in the captivity there, or stayed in the what was formerly the Babylonian Empire, but now the Medo-Persian Empire. The account of the book of Esther, for those of you who take notes and put these things in your Bible, the account of the entire book, which really covers about 10 years, fits exactly in between chapters 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra. The book of Esther is one of the things that is so fascinating about it. It is one of only two books in the entire Bible in which the name of God is not used. It shares that distinction with the book of Song of Solomon. There's all manner of speculation as to why the name of God is not used in, you know, the book of Esther. One of the reasons that some feel that God didn't associate his name with the book was, though he authored it, absolutely, but the reason his name isn't there right on the surface, is that the Jews, when the doors were open for them to return back to Jerusalem, that they should have en masse, not just 50,000 with Zerubbabel and, you know, a few thousand with Ezra, but they should have flocked out of that Persian Empire and returned en masse to the land of promise that God had promised to them. Now the door was opening up. And because they failed to do that, the reason that they failed to do it is they had become comfortable in that Babylonian Empire and also comfortable in the Persian Empire. They had become successful. Their businesses were relatively successful. And so why go back to Jerusalem where it's going to be hot, it's going to be sweaty, they're going to be involved in construction? Those of you who are involved in construction in the Central Valley in the summertime, you get a sense for this, the heat of it. They're going to go and they're going to build a temple there. And then Nehemiah goes over and he's going to build a wall. It was going to be rough, hard work. And so they looked at it and they said, no, we're not really interested in that. We know we should go. We know that that's probably what God would have us to do, but we're not going to head in that direction. And it's much easier to live this life that we're living here in the kingdom that we've been carried away to. And what God is going to teach His people through the book of Esther is, yes, there were trials to be found in Jerusalem. There are always trials to be found in obeying the will of God. It's not easy. We're not home yet. We're behind enemy lines. And so it's going to be difficult. But there is something more difficult than obeying God, and that is to disobey Him and to ignore His call upon my life or His call upon the life of those people. It was going to take the children of Israel 4 months to travel from Shushan, from that Persian capital, to Jerusalem. And then under Nehemiah, it would take them 52 days to build the wall. So we're looking at slightly less than 6 months. You say, I don't want 6 months of trial like that. It's not worth it to me. And so what is God going to allow? He's going to allow in this Persian kingdom for the Jews to go through a trial that's going to last an entire year, where they fear for their lives. In other words, again, the lesson for us: so often when God reveals His will or He calls us out to do something, looks like nothing could be harder. Yes, there is something harder. And that's not doing what He calls us to do. And so God delivered them out of the problem that they come into in the book of Esther. Yes, we are getting to the book of Esther in just a minute, but He delivers them out of the difficulty in His grace. But He doesn't allow His name to be used in the book. So they feel like God's saying, listen, my grace is there and all those things, but I'm not going to associate my name with what looks like a mixed multitude. Well, that may or may not be. It has a great lesson to it and all. But I think that there's another theme as it relates to Esther, and the best theme for the book of Esther and the best explanation for the fact that God's name isn't used is that it's not used by design. And He's making a point there. And the point that He's making is that sometimes He's hidden, but He's always present. Always present. Among His people, sometimes He seems like He is hidden, but He is always present. There's so many times in our life where, you know, He's out of our sight, and we then assume that we're out of His sight. But the lesson of Esther is that though He may be out of our sight at times, we are never out of His sight. He is always working, always working. There are no accidents. There are no coincidences. One of the great lessons of Esther also is that the Lord just communicates through the book, don't worry, I win. And that really, that's the theme of the whole Bible. It's good to read Revelation. See how the book ends. Kind of a bad start. Good first couple of chapters. Got a little messy in chapter 3 and kind of messy, you know, thereafter, except for the presence of the Lord. But He just says in this book and reveals it that He is going to win. It's almost like the Lord gives us a snapshot of what we see in life. We're going to be looking at a wicked king. We're going to be looking at a wicked servant of that king. We're going to be looking at Mordecai and Esther, who aren't exactly kosher in their handling of some different things. And it's almost like God kind of stands back and gives us the snapshot of the circumstances in Esther and just says, okay, Ahasuerus, go ahead and do whatever you're going to do. Haman, go ahead and do whatever you're going to do. You know, Mordecai, do what you're going to do. And Esther, you do what you're going to do, and do whatever you want. But the time comes where I step in and I cause it all to praise me. I make it to praise me. I step in and do exactly what I want. He overrules it for His purposes. That's a great comfort in our lives, is that He is sovereign. He's almighty. I like that. When the Lord came to Moses there in that burning bush, and Moses is kind of chatting with the Lord, and then he's going to take the message of the Lord to the Hebrew people, and then he said, "Oh, by the way, what's your name? Who should I tell him sent me?" And God says, "I am that I am. Tell him the I am sent you." Oh, yes! I love the message this morning where the scoffer and the mocker, and the Lord just looks and says, "Who cares what you think? What made you think anyone cares, let alone that I care as it relates to your opposition and your mocking of me?" The Lord is sovereign. The word means that He's almighty. He is almighty. He does what He wants, when He wants, how He wants. He is God. And He's not some low-fat version of God or some reduced-calorie God. He is God. That's what He is that. Now, the fact of the matter is the sovereignty of God would scare every one of us to death if we didn't understand that in Christ Jesus, He has committed to using His sovereignty for our good. And so we glory in His sovereignty. We glory in, no matter how bad things get, and they're going to get bad for the Jews in Shushan and in the whole region of the Persian Empire. But there's always that understanding that, I mean, even when it goes to the darkest of the darkest of the darkest, where it looks like nothing will overrule it, that God steps in at times like that and He says, "I overrule it, and I overrule it right now, and I haven't even lost my breath in doing it. It's very simple for me." And so He is sovereign, and His sovereignty, His almightiness, is one of the themes of this book. So now we get into it. "Now it came to pass," chapter 1, verse 1, "in the days of Ahasuerus," and that was the king of Persia at that time. He is known, oh, forgive me for a little more historical background. He is the son of Darius the Great, or Darius the First. In history, he's known as Xerxes. That's what his name is in the secular account of things outside of the Bible. What do we know about Xerxes? We know he was a madman, just about. He was a flake. Can you call a king a flake? But that's what he was. The emperor of the greatest kingdom known to man in that day, and yet you never knew where this guy was going to be at when you approached him. He could be one clear on one end of the spectrum or clear on the other end of the spectrum emotionally or whatever. There was a time where he ordered a bridge to be built over a Hellespont. And then when the bridge was built, a storm came in and blew the bridge down. And he was so furious that the bridge had been blown down that he sent his soldiers out to scourge the sea with 50 lashes. And then he threw these shackles, these, you know, glorified handcuffs out into the ocean in order to, you know, to shackle as if that would do that, the storm and the sea. And then he took the builders of that bridge and he beheaded every one of them. It was dangerous to work for him. Government work. Today we like it. It was a little rougher back then. He had a friend who was one of his kind of his allies, and he came to Ahasuerus and asked him to join him in a battle. And he put forth an enormous sum of money to Ahasuerus in order to fund the battle. And Ahasuerus' heart was so touched that he would be willing to pay for, you know, the battle, for the war, that he sent all of the money back and waged the battle, foot the bill for the Persian army himself. And then it wasn't very long after that, in heading out to another battle, that same man had one more son left to carry on his name. And he sent a message to Ahasuerus, and he said, listen, I've only got one more son to carry my name, to follow me. Would you release him from military duty with you? And Ahasuerus was so offended by it that he cut the man's son in two right in front of him, and then made the man go to war with him. And Ahasuerus was at the front of the army. The army was between him and this other man, and then forced him to go into battle. Flaky like that. And we're going to see in the account that's the kind of a guy that he was. And so weird. He had all of these resources, the whole world at his feet, really, to use. And yet, just in terms of emotional stability, he just didn't have it. And so it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. That's a pretty big area, from India to Ethiopia to reign. And I mean, he had a lot of power and he had a lot of wealth. And in those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all of his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. And so he has just historically defeated the Egyptians. He's kind of feeling his Wheaties. He's feeling like he's invincible. And now he wants to go against the Greeks, wants to wipe out the Greeks. So he brings his rulers together. But he's not going to bring them together for a potluck. That's not the way you win friends and influence people. He calls for this huge banquet so that they'll come in and just be in awe at all of the gold and all of the, alcohol and all of the riches and all of the beauty. And then when he says, by the way, let's go ahead and take on the Greeks, that there'll be no spirit left in them to oppose him, even if the plan, was nutty. And so all of this was by design to convince them to follow after him in the conquering of the Greeks. Notice in verse 4, so they came when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. That's how long it took him to show his rulers his wealth. Now, they probably didn't all come in at once. They probably came in teams, because he's not going to take for 6 months all of his chief people out of the field. That would leave you vulnerable. But he brought them in. Took him 6 months to show them the greatness of his wealth. Now, I can show you the greatness of my wealth in about 90 seconds. Can you imagine the kind of wealth that it takes 6 months to show the people that? Now, the fascinating thing is, I mean, if we really get in awe of something like that, you just think, wow, that is amazing, until we find out what the Lord says about his wealth in Ephesians 2. He says, and you, speaking of us as Christians, he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. But God, who is rich in mercy, because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you've been saved, and raised us up together, and made us sit together in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. That's how secure our salvation is. He already sees me up there. I like that kind of security. And he has raised us up together, made us to sit together in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus. For what purpose? That in the ages to come, he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness towards us in Christ Jesus. Took this guy 6 months to show the enormity of His wealth. The Lord says it's going to take forever and ever and ever and ever for us to begin to even scratch the surface as it relates to the richness of His grace. Maybe you're here tonight and you think you've tapped Him out. Been a bad boy recently. You think there's no forgiveness. He's just issuing it out by the thimbleful. He's got quite a bit. He lavishes us with grace when we repent and turn back to Him. And so here's this great King, but this great King pales in comparison to our great King. And so when the feast, these days, verse 5, were completed, the King made a feast lasting 7 days for all of the people who were present in Shushan the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So he apparently, for those 7 days, did bring all of his rulers together for that, but not for the full 180. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen, and purple on silver rods, and marble pillars, as they describes the palace and all. The couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. Now, for you and I, if you, you know, if we go to one another's house and you open up, you know, my cupboard and all of the glasses are different, it's an indication that I'm not so rich. You remember collecting those as a kid, those Welch's grape jelly glasses with the Flintstones on them. And, you know, I mean, you open them up and it's just a collection of hodgepodge. Well, that's for us. He took and didn't want everything to be the same. He wanted every one of them to be unique. Again, that flaunting of his wealth there. You look at it and it's really a shame that a king or a ruler would take that much wealth to himself instead of using it for the purposes that God elevates kings for. There's no reason for what this guy does and really what this guy has. The enormity of the waste that is on the face of the planet. One of the things that's fascinating to me about the millennial reign, the thousand-year reign of Jesus, is that, you know, he could just return at his second coming and wipe them out in the battle of Armageddon, and then gone ahead and done away with a thousand-year reign and headed right on into a new heaven and a new earth. But he doesn't do that, and there are several reasons why he doesn't do that. But I think one of them is that he wants to take a thousand years just to show us what could have been done with this same earth. It's going to be a new, it's going to be the same exact earth, only under a righteous head. And he's going to say, let me show you what was here all of the time and what could have been if I wasn't facing the competition of fallen man as it relates to what could have been related to the earth. And it's going to be astounding. Another testimony of the fact that man is not innately good. Again, the sinful nature of man. And so tragic here. Now, one of the things that I rejoice in, and we're going to get through chapter 1, don't worry about it. Just a bunch of stuff I want to say right here at the beginning, and then I'm going to speed read you out through the end. We'll probably finish the Old Testament tonight. One of the things that I rejoice in, when we're faced with these kind of kings, and he's an evil king, we're going to see it even worse here, is that here the Medo-Persian Empire, it takes our mind back to a vision that was given to Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel interpreted that vision for Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar saw a great image before him. It was an image of a man, and the head was gold, and the chest and the arms were silver, the belly and the thighs were bronze, the legs were of iron, and the feet were made of iron and partly clay. And Daniel spoke to Nebuchadnezzar and said, this is a picture of the world-ruling empires of mankind. You're the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar, but you think you're going to go forever, but you're not. You're going to be followed by another kingdom that's represented by the silver. And that was the Medo-Persian Empire that we read about here. But that empire is not going to last forever. It's going to be followed by an empire represented by the bronze of the belly and the thighs, which spoke of the Grecian Empire that followed the Medo-Persian Empire. But then the Grecian Empire wasn't going to last forever. It was going to be followed by another world-ruling empire, and that was the Romans, symbolized by the legs of iron. And that empire wasn't going to last forever. And the final world-ruling empire of man's ruling is going to be, is pictured by feet made up of clay and of iron. In other words, it'll still have the influence of Rome geographically there in terms of the old European area. And yet the 10 toes, there is, you know, individual identity. There's a unity as there's a unity with a foot. There's a unity there, and yet the 10 toes maintain an individual identity. And so it is in the last days. There'll be some kind of a unity in the area of the old Roman Empire. Something, you know, 10 nations coming together. So, you know, listen to me as a Christian. If you ever see, you know, some kind of a unification of Europe, that ever happens in our lifetime, then just know we're in the last days. And of course, we see it today happening. But that isn't the greatest news. The greatest news is then Daniel spoke to Nebuchadnezzar and he said, that image isn't the great thing. What is great is that a stone, not cut with hands, came and it smote that image in its feet, and that image crumbled down, and then a wind came and it blew every vestige of it away, every memory of it away, and that stone speaks of the return of Jesus Christ. And then man's government done. Hip, hip, hooray. And I'm not even from Oakdale. I can't wait until this is... I'm so glad I'm out from under the government of man. I'm under the government of God. And one day it will be done with. And these kind of kings will be done with. And this kind of waste and all will be done with. The Lord is coming back and due very, very soon in my mind. And so looking forward to that. And so this great, you know, feast going on, verse 8, in accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory so that nobody was forced to drink under Persian law, for so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. Queen Vashti, and her name means beautiful woman, so I don't know if she was later named that or, you know, mom and dad just had a hunch or something, you know, but that's what her name means. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. So they had separate feasts going on. On the seventh day, the last day of that feast, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, that's a nice way of saying he was drunk, he commanded Mayuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zithar, and Carcass... I'm probably wrong on that one. So, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, he commanded them to bring Queen Vashti before the king wearing her royal crown in order to show off her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. And so, again, that's what her name, beautiful to behold. And so he sends for her to come into this drunken mess and just to show off, you know, the king's beauty. You know, look at how beautiful my wife is, and, you know, too bad about yours, or some, that kind of a deal where they, you know, where the men like these kind of trophy things. And you laugh, but don't tell me he's higher than that. Well, if you think, we'll keep reading. And so here he is, you know, going to bring her. According to Persian etiquette, this would have been a humiliation for a queen. It just wasn't right to do this to the queen. The king had a responsibility to protect the queen and to protect his subjects, but especially to protect his queen and from this kind of thing. And yet he does this unwise thing in his drunkenness. And then notice in verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs, and therefore the king was furious and his anger burned within him. And you just have to stop and take a moment. We have just had a large section of chapter 1 speak to us about the enormous power and wealth and position that this man has. And here the queen, in the light of all of that, she refuses to go out there. Now she had to know, absolutely had to know, that there was going to be a price to be paid for that. It's going to make him look really bad because he's trying to gain support from all of these other officials to go out and fight against the Greeks. But here, he can't even rule his own house, is the way it's going to look. He can't even rule the queen. And how's he going to take Greece? And so it looks really, you know, bad for him. We don't really know why Queen Vashti declined or refused in this instance, but it is possible that she was pregnant with Xerxes' son, who was Artaxerxes, who would then follow his father and give Nehemiah the permission to go and rebuild the wall. And so she might have been pregnant and said, I'm not going to go out into that, you know, that humiliation. But she refuses, and it's a very, very dangerous situation in what she does. And he is not only furious, but his anger burned within him. And so what did he do? The king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice. One of the characteristics of Ahasuerus was he had a core group of rulers that he listened to, and they kind of could talk him into a lot of different things. When you have, you know, this kind of passion back and forth, you can be talked into a lot of different things. So he calls in his counselors here to find out what needs to be done, those who were closest to him, and they're listed there. In verse 14, seven princes of Media, of Persia and Media, who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom. And he said, what shall we do to Queen Vashti? Here's a man who, of course, because of his pride, he won't admit that he was wrong. He won't admit, what he ought to do is look at it and say, I am one of the stupidest men in history. What in the world am I doing here? I deserved what I got. I asked for folly and I got folly. But he's not going to do that. He's going to try and save face here. So what do we do with Queen Vashti according to the law? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs. And Mayuman answered before the king and the princes, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. This could get around. We're all in trouble. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women. There does seem to be a pipeline, you know, and I don't mean that derogatorily, but among men and women, when whoever gets a hero, the word is out fast, so you can be sure that this spread very, very quickly that Queen Vashti had done this. And so it's going to become known to all of the women so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. Well, only if they do something as dumb as Ahasuerus. So they're broad brushing here. When they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen, and thus there will be excessive contempt and wrath, not the normal level. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before Queen Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. And then the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great. All wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. Best way to gain honor is to be honorable. Decree, you know, the Lord tells us to, you know, submit to one another, and tells the husband to love his wife as Christ loved the church, tells the wife to submit to her husband as unto the Lord. But, you know, best to be honorable and not have your wife submitting to you by decree. It's right here in the feet. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of this guy. And so he sent letters to all of the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be master in his own house and speak in the language of his own people. Now, one of the things about the Persian empire is that it was really at the forefront of what ultimately became known in the United States and the frontier as the Pony Express. And so they set their form of the Pony Express, headed out with this decree into all of the land, so that everyone would understand what a strong leader Ahasuerus was, and so that there wouldn't be any confusion as it relates to the fact that he is still the king. Now, as this whole thing is unfolding, you know, it just looks like life unfolding. It just looks like a bunch of coincidences, you know, unfolding. But God's involved in all of it, because he knows there's going to need to be a new queen in order to save his people in the realm of Persia. So much of what we're watching, that's one of the things about prophecy. Half the time you don't have it figured out till it's already fulfilled, it's done, and then you go, see how that went, and all. And so here is this thing where it's just, life is just unfolding, and yet God is working mightily in it. No coincidences, no accidents in any of it. Now, between chapter 1 and chapter 2, there's a period of 4 years that pass, that passage is silent related to it, where Ahasuerus does attempt to defeat the Greeks, and he is defeated disastrously. He's defeated in a great, great way. And so he comes back defeated, and we pick it up in that context in chapter 2. Now, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. And then the king's servants who attended him said, you know, probably noticing his loneliness, no queen, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Hegai. The king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them, and then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. And this thing pleased the king, and he did so. And so now the search goes out now for young virgins to be gathered to find one that will be pleasing to the king to be the next queen. Now in Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. And he was the son of Jair, son of Shimei, the son of Kish of Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, and Esther's name means star, his uncle's daughter, so they were cousins. He brought her up, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And so it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of this guy, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of this man, the custodian of the women. He was in charge of the harem. I have often thought in this pop culture that we live in, where, you know, only the most beautiful of beautiful people make it on the face of these magazines and in these TV things and movies and all of this kind of stuff. And they just had one of the Hemingway girls there that had become so famous as a model at just 17 or 19 years of age. And then they ended up finding her dead in her apartment. And her whole life was just a tragedy. Just a tragedy. And sometimes, you know, where this is what's always elevated, and you see so many casualties as a result of it, you just have to think that for those people who are born and they grow into extraordinary beauty, that it must become a curse at some point in life. And it did for these women, because the life of being a part of a king's harem was a very lonely life, very comfortable life. You're taken care of, but you might only see him one time the entirety of your life. It just miserable. And I can't help but think as I read this passage that many of these young maidens that were being brought in cursed their beauty because it had made them attractive to an Ahasuerus. And again, so often today, you know, where you see a person with great beauty, and what happens? Their life is just this succession of attracting Ahasuerus's until there can come a point where they curse their beauty and wish that they weren't attractive to gain this kind of attention. Much better to, you know, live on a farm somewhere and have one man who loves you and will care for you and appreciate you. And so, you know, same thing all through history. And so all of these women are brought in. Verse 9, now the young woman pleased him, as Esther is brought in, pleased this custodian of the women. And he saw that she was beautiful right off. And she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. And seven choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace. And he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. And so he has an idea that king's going to like her. And so he begins to help her out. Now, when these young virgins were brought into Shushan, they were put on a special diet for the king. They were just sex objects. That's all it was. And so they put on a special diet and then a special means of preparation in terms of perfumes, as we'll see in just a moment. And Esther had not revealed her people that she was a Jew or kindred, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. And each young woman's turn came to go into the king after she had completed 12 months preparation. You know, you just want to say to a guy like that, get a grip. He wouldn't see anyone without 12 months of preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months of preparation with the oil of myrrh, and 6 months preparation with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Like a picture of him. And thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In other words, when she was called, she could take whatever garments or whatever she wanted to take with her into that. I mean, there it is a possibility of becoming a queen, so they, some of them would want to look attractive on that. And in the evening she went, and in the morning she would return to the second house of the woman, to the custody of Sheuskas, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. And she would not then go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abigail, the uncle of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. You know, listen, you give me the jewelry, you give me the dress, you know this guy better than I do, and so you do what you think is right. And of course, this guy would know what pleased the king. That was his job, was to keep the king pleased. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. And so Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the other women. Now that's a qualifying statement. I don't think this man knew how to love. You know, lust might be a better word for it. And she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. And so he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then the king made a great feast, the Feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants. And he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. He wanted everyone to feel good about the new queen. And so what better way than to have a feast and feed everybody? Verse 19. Then virgins were gathered together a second time. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. He's probably received a position with the king, sitting in the king's gate. Now Esther had not yet revealed her kindred and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. And in those days, when Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, big, thin, Teresh, doorkeepers, really kind of like bodyguards, became furious and they sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. They wanted to kill him. Maybe they were upset over the way that Vashti had been treated. We really don't know, but it's a plot to kill the king. And so the matter became known to Mordecai, who then told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king and Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. Both the men were hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Now, this is a weird thing. Mordecai does something that saves the king's life, and he receives no reward. Now, I don't know about you, but you know, maybe your nature is so base as to think that when you do something good like saving the king's life, you ought to get a watch out of it, a nice gold chain, some money, a promotion, something like that out of it. The fascinating thing is he does something good and he does what's right and he receives no reward. No reward. And he's not going to receive a reward for 4 years. It's like he does something good and nobody cares. It's like, I just saved the king's life. Got a little I saved the king's life badge. And I mean, nothing. Nothing. No promotion. Nothing out of it. Have you ever been in a place where you've done what's right? You've done above and beyond. And then in doing it thought, this is going to, wow, what this is going to turn into for me. Woo-hoo-hoo! I mean, can't wait. And then nothing. Nothing. When that happens, know that it will be worth the wait when God repays you. It is going to be worth the wait for Mordecai for how God is going to choose to repay him for what it is that he did here. It's going to be very good, very yummy. In chapter 6, just excellent. Some of you may be sitting on a situation tonight where you've done something and, you know, grumbling, nobody, and I, where's my Lord, just pay, you know, serving you didn't even get me, and I did what's right and nothing, you know, and ooh, just wait and see what the Lord does. Well, we'll head into chapter 3 here. It's just a point or two, and we'll head right on through, have you out of here in no time. And after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of this guy, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. This guy is going to really cause some problems for the Jews. He's a Jew hater. Haman is a Jew hater. And he's going to become one, and he's going to become a confirmed Jew hater. One of the fascinating things is we're told something about Haman there in verse 1, and that is that he was an Agagite. Agag was the king that Saul had been commanded by God to wipe out with all of the Amalekites. He was the ruler of the Amalekites. Haman is a descendant of the Amalekites, of the royal family of Agag. This is a great lesson for us, because when God spoke to Saul and said, I want you to utterly destroy the Amalekites, Saul was supposed to do it, and he didn't do it. He ultimately was killed by an Amalekite. The Amalekites were descendants of Esau, which are a type of the flesh in the Scriptures. And so here he takes and he refuses to obey God's command. He himself pays a price for it, and that he's killed by an Amalekite, but his people are going to pay a price for it, in that Haman is going to try to utterly destroy the Jews. And if Saul had obeyed the Lord, there would not be a Haman on the scene in this day to even attempt to destroy the Jews. Again, when God comes to us and he tells us to do something. Now, he doesn't call us to kill anyone today. But when he comes to us and tells us to deal with the flesh or utterly wipe out something of the flesh or to do something for him, he's not going to stop and say, now listen, several hundred years from now, if you don't do this, there'll be a guy by the name of Haman. He'll be right raising up at a time when there is a, you know, world-ruling empire known as the Persians, and he is going to be ruling over that empire. His name's going to be Ahasuerus, and he's going to bring a guy in about chapter 3 of Esther and bring him into a place, and he's going to, you know, put a decree out to kill all of your people. God doesn't go into all that. He just comes and he says, this is what you need to do, and do it. And all of his commands carry that kind of weight. There's a reason. There are reasons. He doesn't over-explain them. He just expects us to obey them and then know everything's going to be all right. So Saul's disobedience, very far-reaching among the Jewish people. And so this Haman is promoted. And all of the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. So he's, you know, he's a big shot and everyone's bowing down. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage to him. He wouldn't bow down. Now, he has done everything that he could to hide the fact that he's a Jew. But, you know, sooner or later, something comes up that's going to force him to reveal the fact that he's a Jew. And it's the same way for us as Christians. Isn't it how the person is going to hide, try and hide, go undercover as much as they... But sooner or later, there comes a situation that it would be compromised to do something, and then all of a sudden, I have to reveal what I am. It's a great thing. It's a part of God's plan. And so he wouldn't bow down. And the king's servants who were with in the king's gate, they said to Mordecai, they liked him. Why are you transgressing the king's command? What are you crazy? This guy's powerful. Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, asking him the same thing, that he wouldn't listen to them. And they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. And then when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. He said, all right, I could kill this guy, But no, he's got bigger dreams than that. For they had told him of the people of Mordecai, and instead Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. And so here he is, he's upset with Mordecai, he's upset with a single Jew, and he finds out about the fact that Mordecai won't bow down to him. It makes him mad, and he's so mad that he not only plots the death of Mordecai, but now he plots the death of all of the Jewish people. Haman, again, he's a Jew hater. Really, he's a classic picture of the prejudiced man. You notice what he does. He comes to conclusions about an entire race of people. He comes to hate an entire race of people based upon contact with one member of that race, based upon an unfavorable single contact with a member of that race, as if any single human being can properly represent in its entirety any race. Now, that's the way that prejudice is. It's the same way today. How many people hate entire groups of people because they had an unfavorable experience with just one member of that particular kind of person? Of course, it has no place in our lives as Christians. We're not to be respecters of persons. But here is Haman. It's a classic thing. All through history, he wants to take and wipe out an entire race of people because he had having a bad experience with one of them. How many people reject Christ because they had a single bad experience with, one Christian? Doesn't make any sense at all. And so his heart is completely wrong in all of this. And in the first month, verse 7, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, which means lot, that is the lot, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. And so Haman is a man who worships the stars. He worships the false gods. And so what does he do? He goes to these false gods now, casts lot to find out, okay, I want to wipe them out. What's going to be the best day to do that? And what does the lot fall on? Well, he casts the lot in the first month, and the lot falls on the 12th month. So the Lord is in this kind of thing. The Lord's going to give, 12 months for this whole thing to backfire on him. And so he's got to wait a full year to do what's in his heart. And then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different. Yeah, so let's kill them. From all other peoples. And of course, the different person has always been subject to this kind of thing. And the Jews have always been a different people on the face of the planet. It's fascinating, though, is that, is every single person that has tried to destroy the Jews has ended up destroyed. The Jews continue. Why? Because of the blessing that God had spoken in Genesis, chapter 12 concerning the Jew, when he said to Abraham and the nation that he was going to bring out of Abraham, he said, I will bless those who bless you. I will curse him who curses you. And you, in you, all of the families of the earth shall be blessed. Speaking of the fact that Messiah would come through them. And so here he is, though they're different. And then he says, and they do not keep the king's laws. And therefore it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. Now, the entire year's wealth that the entire empire of Persia would bring in a year was 15,000 talents of silver. This guy is offering 10,000 talents to fund the extermination. This is a very, very wealthy man. And so the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, and the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. And then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded. To the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all people, to every province according to its script, to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring, and the letters were sent by couriers into all of the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. And so I think that's where Haman probably thought he'd get his money back, is in the plundering of the prosperity of the Jews. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. And the couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan the citadel. And so the king and Haman sat down to drink. Imagine that. You've just signed the death warrant of millions of people, and now you're going to sit down to eat and drink. But the city of Shushan was perplexed.